A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And I'm Rogan Graham.
On the show this week, it's a Nope special, and we dive deep into Jordan Peele's latest Bad Miracle. And on Film Club, we look at a couple of classics which inspired Nope, Hitchcock's The Birds and Steven Spielberg's blockbuster Jaws. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Welcome, Hannah. Welcome, Rogan, as we all sit here sweating on a lovely London morning. Hannah, it's always wonderful to have you back. But Rogan, I think this is your first time with me as host.
It is. Hi. Welcome. Well, no, not welcome, but kind of welcome. Congrats on the new job.
Thank you. And I want to say congrats on the fact that I think probably by the time this comes out, it'll be sold out, but you are doing possibly what you were set on this planet to do, like having a screening. You want to talk about the screening that's happening this weekend?
Yes. So it is sold out. Sold the final two tickets yesterday. This Sunday at Barbican, I will be hosting a screening of Mariah Carey's 2001 film, Glitter. And it is the honour of a lifetime, honestly. I'm a massive Mariah Carey fan, but also it's just really fun to be able to put on a really campy screening and then do an introduction that sort of digs into the lore of why the film did so badly and why it's actually not as bad as we'd like to remember, and just really kind of stand out in front of an audience who paid to be there. That's, you know, instead of just ranting at my friends, that's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it does seem like people were really keen to take Mariah Carey down when Glitter came out. Like, I think there was probably a lot of sexism in it. It felt like, you know, how dare this woman think she's a multi-hyphenate?
It was all misogyny and the evil ex-husband. It always goes back to the evil ex-husband, Layla.
Is it Tommy Mottola?
Tommy Mottola, yeah. So he never wanted her to act. I mean, I could do the whole presentation now. He never wanted her to go into acting because it was something he couldn't control, essentially, because he was the head of Sony Music. And then when she divorced and left Sony Music, the film was already in production under Sony Pictures, or I think it was Columbia, but it's still under the umbrella. So he still had ways to control and sabotage and leak the soundtrack and get, you know, certain Jennifer Lopez's on songs that were never meant to be hers, and so on and so forth. So there's a real rich history there. And I'm very excited to get into it in front of, a sold-out crowd.
Oh, that's fantastic. Hannah, any, like, films that you think were, like, really unfairly maligned when they first came out that you, you know, in a dream scenario would love to present before an audience?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I mean, this one has been reappraised, but I very much like Michael Mann's Miami Vice, which was kind of trashed when it came out and suffered a lot of production problems. Excuse me. And that has kind of seen a bit of a reappraisal in subsequent years. But I would love to see that at the cinema. I think it has this incredible opening where it just sort of throws you right into this undercover sting at a nightclub and numb. Slash encore, the Linkin Park Jay-Z mashup is playing, and it just goes really hard. But I'm generally like a big fan of reappraising films. I think it's you know, the critics don't always get it right, and we've got to be big enough to admit that.
It was really sweet when the recent Jackass film came out, is that you could track the Jackass films on Rotten Tomatoes as the scores just got higher and higher and higher and higher, and they just went from being kind of considered trash culture to just, like, wonderful, like, and a wonderful institution that's holding our society together.
Yeah, I mean, I could do a whole podcast about how I feel about the Jackass movies and how they were treated initially, but that will save for maybe when the next one comes out. But yeah, I do think it's been nice to see. I think obviously, like, the critical landscape changes from generation to generation. I think there is something in the idea that critics who grew up watching Jackass are now, you know, in a position to kind of actually explain why it's really good and maybe why it didn't get a fair shake the first time around, which, you know, you love to see it.
Well, just glad to hear that it's not actually all down to Johnny Knoxville having an evil ex-husband who's doing stuff behind the scenes to sabotage his career. But yeah, I mean, like, well, I suppose let's get on to the film in question. Someone who is, you know, to be fair, being appreciated in the time that he is working, Jordan Peele's Nope. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. New members will gain access to our newly launched Discord channel, where we'll be giving live updates on movies, magazines, and everything else. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to the Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. After a small object falling from the sky results in the death of their father, ranch-owning siblings OJ and Emerald Haywood fall on hard times and have to sell many of their prized horses to a child star turned neighboring theme park owner, Jupe Park. When they spot an unidentified flying object in the sky above the ranch, they join forces with tech salesman Angel Torres and documentarian Antlers Holst and try and make a fortune by capturing it on film. Like, I've got to say, Regan, I was excited for this film. For, you know, obvious reasons, but I could not have gotten more excited than when I saw a 555 from you, because the last time that happened was Mangrove, and I was kind of going slightly insane in my house, just being like, oh my god, a Rogan 555 has dropped!
Oh my god. Yeah, I mean, I've seen that. I've been really lucky to see the film twice. So I was kind of anxious, honestly. I was like, am I going to stand by this 555, seeing the film again? And, like, halfway through the film, I saw it with Hannah, and I turned to her and I went, this is really good. And I do, in fact, stand by my 555 review. I mean, it's just wonderful. It's so great to just watch people, filmmakers, actors, at the height of their powers, and trusting the audience. You know, I feel like a lot of the big guys can be really patronizing. A lot of the big films that come out, a lot of the tentpoles, really patronizing and really insulting, honestly, to audiences with all these asides and the hand holding. And you know, Jordan Peele knows how good his ideas are, and he knows how talented he is, and he knows and trusts the people he works with. But there's no smugness. It's just pure enjoyment. And yeah, I think that there was definitely a lot of pressure, I think, with his third feature, Get Out being the kind of phenomenon that it was, is, and all the kind of rip-offs that you get and references and just how quickly it became embedded into culture. And then Us didn't quite land in the same way. I thought Us was great, really strong film, but I don't think what people were expecting. So I don't think it wasn't taken the way that Get Out was. So I think people were sort of on the edge of their seats with this one. Like, what is he going to do? Is he going to do it again? Or was he sort of a one-trick pony? Which is such an insult, really. And I think something that is, you know, black directors, women directors and so on, how to that. But yeah, how do you guys feel about it? I think the same, but...
I suppose the thing with Jordan Peele is, like, even coming into this, there is obviously an insane expectation around it, because not only is Get Out winning Oscars, and is Us, you know, and Us got, you know, a fair amount of acclaim, you know, perhaps not the same level, but certainly Lupita Nyong'o was considered to be wonderful, and I think most people like that film. But he's kind of got to be the critical darling and also do mega box office. Like, these films tend to make, you know, a couple of $100 million. So, and there's nobody really else that's got the burden of representation, the burden of, like, I have to get, like, above 90 on Rotten Tomatoes, and I have to crack $200 million with my movies. But Hannah, you were a Jordan Peele fan coming into this? I know you like the film.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I really liked Get Out, and I really liked Us. I agree with Rogan. I think that maybe the kind of expectations with Us were so high, the film kind of really couldn't hope to possibly meet audience kind of... you know, audience and critical ambition there. But, I mean, Lupita Nyong'o is, like, incredible in that film. I still think, like, she really didn't get the respect she deserves for how good she is in that film. But Nope, I was very excited about. I love an alien movie. And from the start, with the kind of first information that was coming out about the film, it kind of felt like it would be an alien film. I remember having quite a few conversations with David. I was like, it's definitely aliens. And he was like, well, it's Jordan Peele, you know, he's not that obvious. He's not gonna make it about aliens. And then he did, and I felt really smug. But yeah, so I was very kind of in for this. And then obviously you add in this incredible cast lineup, you know, him reuniting with Daniel Cleo, which is such a huge draw, and then Kiki Palmer, who I adore, and I'm very happy to see her do anything, and Steven Yeun, who's obviously, we love Steven Yeun, we've talked about him a lot on this podcast. So yeah, it was a very enticing trio kind of at the centre of the film for me as well, and I just think that Peele is such an original filmmaker, and I'm very glad that he has seemingly so far been able to go down this road of making these huge blockbusters without having to kind of compromise his original storytelling, and not having to kind of go off and do a Marvel movie or something. You know, he's getting the kind of budgets that these stories require, and certainly Nope is definitely his most ambitious film. You think about the scale of it and what kind of special effects this film requires. It's really hard to get into this kind of thing without, like, doing any spoilers, because obviously it's just coming out in the UK this week. But yeah, I was so hyped for it, and then very much I saw it with Rogan both times, actually, and we were just kind of like living the entire time. It's such a great, it's everything you want from a kind of big summer blockbuster, and seeing it in, like, IMAX particularly, it really is like a overwhelming experience in the best way.
Yeah, no, I found myself kind of almost transcending to new levels of joy at several points. But I mean, to say this film is about aliens is kind of, you know, really reducing it down. I mean, we have had a discussion beforehand about what quantifies as spoilers. And, you know, if you are listening to the podcast, do not worry. We are not going to give away many of the big twists and turns that come in this film, but fair to say that there is an unidentified flying object, and some shit goes down. One of the things that it keeps coming back to is this kind of use of animals in Hollywood. We have, you know, the Haywoods themselves are running this ranch with these horses, which they kind of rent out to, like, films like The Scorpion King, and then there's the chimps. And I believe it's the first scene in the film, so we can talk about that. There is an incident on a sitcom set where a chimp attacks the cast. And this is something that has, you know, been witnessed by one of the characters, and we keep flashing back to it. But what do you think of the way that Jordan Peele kind of had a look at animal usage in Hollywood?
I mean, I thought it was really interesting, and I thought it was quite a funny route to go down, because I suppose it's not really at the forefront of people's minds. It was maybe something that him growing up, you know, that was more of a thing. I know that the Gordy, the chimp situation it was, I think, inspired by something that actually happened. But of course, I mean, I was born in the 90s, so that it was, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. We don't do that anymore. So it's not so much at the forefront of my mind, but it clearly is for him. And I think, yeah, that the theme running through the film is, you know, it's prey versus predator, I suppose, and people grappling not to be the prey and trying to outsmart the predator, essentially, to, you know, varying degrees of success, without any spoilers. But I think in the terms of, you know, animal versus human, it works. But then, of course, you get into the whole grander idea about Hollywood and who's the prey, who's the predator, who's generating what and for what means. And yeah, I'm trying really hard not to, not to spoil. But yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to say that the chimp attack, because this is one of my special interests, is which so makes me sound slightly insane, but I'm fascinated by the idea of performing animals in general, because it is something that when I was a kid, I would watch like Dr. Doolittle or something, and they would have actual bears and actual monkeys and things performing. But in our lifetime, we've seen this massive switch where it's been acknowledged now how kind of cruel this can be. And VFX have come on so far since then, there's just really no need for it anymore. So again, not a spoiler to say that Terry Notary has quite a big role, or quite a key role, I should say, in this film. And Terry Notary is a fantastic actor who is known mostly for his mocap performances. He was in all the Planet of the Apes films. If you need a monkey, you go to Terry. That's what I like to say. So he plays the chimpanzee in this film. And as Rogan said, it was based on a real attack. It was based on an incident where a monkey, a chimpanzee called Travis, who had actually been an actor, had been in Coca-Cola commercials, he'd been in on Maury and stuff in America, he attacked his owner's friend, and she was incredibly, like, seriously injured by this, and the chimp was put down on the spot by the police, who responded. So that, I think, is kind of the most famous incident of a performing animal kind of turning on its not on its handler in this case, but, you know, obviously on someone close to the handler. And I think that idea of the unpredictability of wildlife and man's kind of desire to tame the untamable kind of feeds in a lot to Note. But also, I mean, it goes really far into this really interesting idea of, as Rogan just mentioned, like the idea of who in Hollywood is doing the kind of hard work and whose labor is filmmaking based on, and what gets sacrificed in the pursuit of fame and fortune and storytelling. And there's this kind of amazing lore that the film is based on, or where Emerald, played by Kiki Palmer, gives the speech about their Hayward horses and how their great great great, I want to say, was it three greats or four greats? Because they joke about it in the
four,
film.
Yeah, I think it might have been four. Great, 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 it's four.
Yeah, great, 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 great grandfather was a jockey who was in the first ever assemblance of photographs used to make a moving, used to make a motion picture. It's quite a mouthful. And he never got any credit for that. So they're kind of used to the way that Black people exploited in Hollywood, but they've made this business, which used to be at the top of its game and has kind of suffered since this bad miracle which happened to their father. And it all kind of feeds back to this idea of exploitation, and I'm just fascinated by Peele's ability to turn something that I think people have kind of been talking about, especially in more recent years, and display it in such an imaginative way. I've never kind of seen anything like this in terms of that theme being interpreted in such a, like, through the lens of, like, genre cinema, but not straightforward horror cinema. Because it's not, it's interesting that this, after his first two films, I think were pretty, you pretty by the book horror films. This is very kind of different.
For sure. I just want to say, yeah, he has so much fun with genre as well, because there are horror elements of this. Of course, it's like, I'd say overarching, it's sci-fi. But there are just these really fun moments where he's just, it's not mocking, but he's just really having fun with genre, with tropes, which was just really refreshing to see, and just see someone, yeah, he knows his stuff.
He really does. And it is a case of seeing someone getting a bigger budget and like really using it. I think he's doing some genuinely like pioneering stuff when it comes to the way he shoots night in this film. And there's kind of such that, like, it doesn't seem like a normal night scene to me. It seems like that thing that when you've been outside in the real dark for like 20 minutes and your eyes have completely adjusted and you can still see everything, but it is pitch black, which I haven't really seen in the same way. But also, this is, again, oh, it's tough not to give anything away, but this is kind of action on a very grand scale, shall we say. And what did you think of the design elements of the actual object in the sky, shall we say?
So I love that Peel is such a nerd, because, you know, I think it's rare to find a filmmaker who is a huge like film and TV nerd, but is able to kind of extrapolate that in a way that feels very fresh and original. So Peel has said like one of his big inspirations for Nope was some nerd is going to get very annoyed listening to this podcast. Neon Genesis Evangelion, I think is what it is. I can't remember the name. I've only ever seen one episode, but I know that it's an anime, kind of iconic anime, has a very strong cult following. And he has, Peel has said, like, the kind of design of the creatures or objects in this film were very much inspired by that. And this idea of something that you expect to be kind of heavenly and celestial and beautiful, and in reality is actually kind of terrifying. And I as someone who went to Catholic school, and I kind of grew up very much indoctrinated in that world, I'm fascinated by the kind of biblical references, allusions in this film. And I loved the, I'm trying really hard not to spoil it, but the idea of something that is supposed to be very beautiful and very spiritual turning out to be kind of monstrous and almost kind of punishing you for your hubris is really kind of thrilling to me. I think it's a very funny film in that respect, and I think Peele doesn't get enough credit for being a really funny filmmaker, which is no surprise coming from the comedy background that he has. But this is like, there's some incredibly funny moments in the film. And I've got to shout out as well, obviously we've talked about Daniel and Kiki, but I want to shout out as well Brandon Perrier, who's like a newer actor, who this is his kind of big breakout role, and he's so good. He plays Angel, the kind of tech support guy, and he's so funny. I love him. I can't wait to see what he does next as well.
Yeah, going through a bad breakup, I kind of like, I really understood exactly who that guy was within about 10 seconds of him coming on screen. I'm just like, I'm working in retail, my girlfriend's got a show on the CW, things aren't like going the way that I hoped they were, and I'm spending a huge amount of time on Reddit looking up UFO conspiracy theories. Like, he's so endearing, though. I think one of the things that was interesting with the start of this film is this Bible quote that comes out. You talked about the Bible a little bit, and I'll read it out. "I will cast abominable filth upon you, make you vile, and make you a spectacle." Like, there is something about spectacle in this film, because it's something that many of the characters refer back to a couple of times. Do you think he's kind of like damning the pursuit of the spectacle in this? Because it doesn't work out well for quite a few of them.
Oh, absolutely. I think Peele again has said like he was very, he was very inspired by writing this film during COVID and seeing the kind of endless news cycle of tragedy, and the fact that we're kind of bombarded on a daily basis by horrific images that we can't look away from, or that people seem to kind of clamour more and more for. And I think the film does kind of hold up a mirror. There's actually some physical holding up a mirror in the film, which is very funny, but it does kind of ask us to question our relationship with tragedy and with things like chimpanzee attacks, and kind of, you know, reevaluate why these things are so kind of interesting, appealing. You know, it reminded me a lot of like the true crime industrial complex, and how like these horrific stories of people losing their lives and being attacked have now become something that is very heavily monetized. And, you know, you'll be watching a video or listening to a podcast, and they'll be talking about some of the worst things that humans can do to each other, and then it'll be sponsored by Blue Apron. Do you need dinner tonight? You know, that kind of like jarring, almost normalization now we have of extreme violence. And obviously, like as a black filmmaker, I think that Jordan Peele has a lot of very interesting ideas around that. And I mean, it's such a great quote as well. It's such a, like, it goes pretty hard, the Old Testament. And, it's a good one. I was very, as soon as that came up, I was like, okay, this film's going to be a ride.
Regan, for you, like, one of the big things that people have been talking about is Kiki Palmer, because she was sort of a bit of a meme machine beforehand. And people, I think a lot of people just adore her, but it's not even that connected to her work. Like, what did you think of her as an actual actress?
Oh, I thought she was wonderful. I think Kiki Palmer's so interesting because she is royalty, like acting royalty in the black American community specifically. You know, she was a child star, and she, you know, she really is jack of all trades. You know, she had her own TV show. She's like a judge on Legendary, which is like this ballroom show. I've had a music career, you know, she's kind of done it all. And it's so interesting because then her internet presence is, you know, kind of like everyone's ears, is cut down to these, you know, entertaining moments. But the idea that this is the film that might introduce her to people, and they have so much more to discover because she is just such a delight on screen. I think especially in the final act, the way she can just turn on a dime to like the levity to just the pure heart, and you just want to protect her. And again, no spoilers, but she just, you know, she has this real ability to just kind of look into the soul of an audience and give you exactly what you need at the right time. She's just, yeah, on a dime, she's that good. She's really wonderful. And it will be interesting, I think, to see, because she's already so big and she is already, like I said, you know, acting royalty, but this is like a very different scale. I think as it is for all of the cast. I forget the actor's name who played Angel, but I'm sure he's having the time of his life at the minute, as, you know, the kind of sneak favourite, I think, for a lot of people who've come in, I'm not sure.
And holding himself, you know, he's managing to kind of have a presence aside Michael Wincott, who I just think is kind of one of the most exciting people that you can put in anything. But I found myself almost most impressed by this film in like the final 15 minutes or so, because the final 15 minutes have very, very little dialogue. Conceptually, it's incredibly complicated what is going on, what the rules are, what just like the vista is, the topography. And then you've got all these different characters with such different motivations, many of whom change their minds as to what they're going to do halfway through it, and almost entirely dialogue free.
You're just kind of awed. I was just like overcome by the scope of it. I remember when I left the first screening, knowing I had to write a review, it's like, I don't think I took enough notes. I was just overcome in the best way possible, because it is just like awe-inspiring, the scale and the sound design. And I'd say probably the most distinctly horror scenes in the movie is when the sound really comes to the the forefront, that just like spine tingling, inescapable noise of the thing in the sky, the object in the sky.
Goosebumps just talking about
it. I know, you know, it is. I'm like, oh, you know, your back goes. it just, the fully subsumed, fully in there, in at times the worst way. And as what saying, I mean, the same with the cinematography. I think there's a night scene, which you did touch on, Van Hoytema, who works with Christopher Nolan a lot. So if you're talking about scale, just to kind of give, you know, any perspective, anyone familiar with his work and the scale he goes in on. But that night scene in particular, and the way Daniel's skin is lit in the car, I think there is, you know, a lot of discussion about the way black skin is lit in film. And I think Bullet Train was a very, like, recent example of it being done really badly. I don't think Brian Tyree Henry looked, you know, was made to look his best in that at all. But then you have Daniel Kaluuya, who's just, like, glistening, you know, in the night sky, you know, in a car, in a thunderstorm. It's just some really, really beautiful images that you just get really swept up in. And again, you're kind of, you're on this ranch, you know, in the middle of nowhere, California. Just, yeah, fully in there. And, but, yeah.
You get a sense of that isolation out there as well. And there's a scene that's like absolutely terrifying, which I'm sure must have been inspired by The Shining. And I'm thinking particularly of the elevators of blood scene in The Shining, where the family, where we've got OJ and Emerald and Angel kind of trying to evade the thing in the sky. And it just is like horrifying to watch, but very, like, you know, invigorating at the same time. And I think that's like the best way to describe this film, horrifying but invigorating. And it is like it's an extremely entertaining film. And I've said before, like, it is funny. There are some very funny moments. And I think the thing that Peele understands about horror is how people actually react in these kind of situations. And I think it is kind of human nature to kind of like panic, and the way that like OJ and Emerald sort of panic is very funny to watch. And there's an amazing scene in a bar, which I won't spoil too much, but watching that with the crowd is just, it was just so satisfying, because the whole crowd were on the edge of their seats, like shouting and kind of like making a noise. And it was just, it's one of those films I cannot recommend enough. I mean, obviously, in an ideal world, everyone would see everything at cinema, but this is definitely one you don't want to miss at the cinema, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I watch a lot of horror films, and I felt about this in many ways like I do about Silence of the Lambs, that this film taught me about things that I didn't know that I was terrified of, like like tiny coins and barns and esophaguses.
Yeah. Many cowboy hats.
Many cowboy hats. But I feel more than anything, it's just something that is so joyful to chew over in the hours and days and weeks that pass after you've seen it. Like, it's now been a bit of time since we've all seen it. We've had time to digest, and new things about it keep popping into my mind, about how in an early scene, there's such a moment on a set where OJ cannot make eye contact with people. Like, he's just too shy. He doesn't have the confidence. And then actually his hero moment at the end comes down a lot to actually making that eye contact. And like, you know, I'll just have a thought like that about this and be like, oh God, another little treat Jordan Peele gave me. Are there any of the things that you've kind of thought about, seen, or maybe even seen online referencing this, that you've kind of particularly enjoyed?
Just the way that things, like callbacks to, and there's a callback like quite late in the film to something to do with Dupe and his childhood, which I thought was like incredible. And I didn't know about that until I saw someone mention it on Twitter. There's been so many kind of amazing reads on the film and people pointing out little Easter eggs and references. I mean, the film is just jam-packed with cinematic references. I mentioned The Shining, but obviously we're going to talk about Hitchcock and Spielberg in a minute, but also M. Night Shyamalan's Signs is kind of, there's like references to that in a very funny way. And it's just such a joy to kind of be part of a community discovering these things about this film. And it has, that's what I think gives it so much rewatch value, is that there's things nestled, hidden away for you to discover, which I really enjoyed.
Rogan, what about you? Anything in retrospect that you've kind of appreciated more with a bit of hindsight?
I was thinking that, so there are these title cards, you know, for the names of the creatures. So there's one for Gordy and then the names of the different horses. And my little brain has been kind of making connections to like, oh yeah, there's Clover and Four Leaf Clovers and Luck, but like False Luck, because that never really happens. And then of course there's the Horse Lucky, and then there's Gordy, and all those kind of little things. Because initially I don't think it's a complicated film to follow, but I do see people will be wanting to overcomplicate it because they think Jordan Peele, you know, he's this really complex genius and you have to get on his level. And it's like, no, he's very, you know, graciously presented you this great fun thing that, you know, is not incredibly complicated, but I can see people overcomplicating it. Anyway, it was the title cards that I find quite interesting to think of those. And yeah, thinking about their, what they mean for each chapter of the film is something that I picked up on the second watch. But I'm going to see it again. I'm going to see it a third time. I mean, maybe a fourth. I don't know. Like, it's great.
God, it does feel that maybe we were born in the wrong time, because perhaps this is what blockbusters used to be, and now they're bullet train. But yeah, I mean, I think this is going to do very well. So perhaps that's, underestimating its box office power. But let's get some scores on this before we move on. Even though I don't want to move on, I just want to talk about this with you all day. But Reagan, do you want to go first? You still dropping that powerful 555?
I'm still 555. Do you know what? Starting this episode talking about Glitter, I'm worried that now that 555 doesn't carry the same weight. But I mean, love Jordan Peele, love Get Out. I love Daniel Kaluuya. I didn't even get into my love for Daniel Kaluuya, which is probably for the best. You know, I don't want to put him off if he was to listen. But big fan. So I'm the first in line to see anything that he's in. And then it's a Jordan Peele film, you know, double that. Throughout, I was literally just on the edge of my seat, like mouth open, laughing, you know, cowering, just having the time of my life. And in retrospect, all those feelings hold up. 555.
Hannah, what about you?
Yeah, I am the same, 555. I try to not go 555, but some films deserve it. And I think that this, after two watches, is definitely one of the best films of the year. It will be high on my end of year list. And again, yeah, like you, like Rogan, I can't wait to see it again. I think it's just such a great time at the cinema. And I am very excited, not only for, you know, whatever Peele does next, but I'm very excited to see more of Brandon Perea. Like, what a little breakout star we've got there.
Yeah, Brandon Perea, Keith David, so good in this. Michael Wincott, I know I've mentioned Michael Wincott again, but like, these to me, Michael Wincott, Keith David, are my two favorite voices in cinema. So the fact that I got to enjoy those kind of velvety, gruff, you know, grisly tones on my eardrums in the same film, I don't think this has actually ever happened on an episode that I've been on before, but 555. I loved it. I was sat there the entire time thinking, like, this was a treat specifically designed for me. And it isn't, but I think that he has such kind of a rich tapestry going on there, and there's so much to take from it and so many different angles to interpret it, that it is possible to just connect with it, like, really personally, very quickly, very fast. And I love that he doesn't over explain a lot of it. I, you know, particularly Duke Park's character, he leaves a lot off the screen, and then there's a lot for you to kind of text your friends afterwards, being just like, well, what was going on there, and how does this business plan work? But yeah. I laughed, I cried, I loved it. Thank you, Jordan Peele, and more of this, please. And everybody, please go and watch it so we get more giant budgeted films from this wonderful filmmaker. Up next, Film Club.
Hold up. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A wealthy San Francisco socialite pursues a potential boyfriend to a small Northern Californian town that slowly takes a turn for the bizarre when birds of all kinds suddenly begin to attack people. Hannah, so, you know, Jordan Peele has not been shy about talking about how much he loves Hitchcock. Are you also a Hitchcock fan?
Not really, which just feels like sacrilege to say. It's funny, when we've all been, everyone in the film community has been doing their Sight and Sound top 10 of the their once a decade top films ever made list, and I didn't have a single Hitchcock on there. I nearly put Rebecca on there because I do love Rebecca, but I'm not. I don't know. I can totally appreciate him as a filmmaker, and Vertigo is obviously like an incredible film, but he's just not someone I've ever really found the time to kind of dive into. And maybe that's something I should look at doing, particularly since he's influenced so many filmmakers I love. But this was my first watch of The Birds, which I think is a film that has been kind of memed to death. There's so many references I now understand, particularly Simpsons references. I think of that incredible episode where Hans Molman gets like stuck in the bird park and he's in the phone booth saying, "I need the biggest bag of bird seed you've got," and the birds are attacking the glass door and he goes, no, that's too big. and like, just things like that, now I finally understand the jokes. But in terms of this film, I can't say like it holds up. It is a unrelentingly ridiculous film. And I think some of that is just, you know, the problem is like technology has moved on so much since Hitchcock was making films, and I try to not be like, you know, I try to take that into account and not be too harsh, but it just looks so silly at some points when they're like running, all the children are running away from the birds, but they're very clearly not in the same shot, and it just looks really, really silly. So I enjoyed it more as a kind of curio and kind of, wow, people used to find this terrifying, than kind of actually finding it suspenseful in the way that I think a lot of Hitchcock's films that I've seen do hold up. I think this is maybe one that doesn't quite look as good now as it did at the time.
Yeah, I think of The Birds as being like no Hitchcock fan's favorite Hitchcock, and if you ever kind of want to impress a Hitchcock geek, if you said that The Birds was your favorite, they would kind of look at you with like great disdain, like, because yeah, the answer to that is, you know, you've got to say it's Vertigo or Rope or Frenzy or something like more obscure. What's this is, I suppose, more blockbustery than most of he does, but far less disturbing. Rogan, was this your first time watching The Birds?
It was my first time watching The Birds, and it's really funny, Hannah, you're talking about, you know, how much technology's moved on, because I mentioned to my mum that, oh, I'm going to be watching The Birds for the podcast. And she went, oh my God, I watched that when I was a little girl. It was so terrifying. No, let me know when you're watching it. I won't be watching it with you, kind of thing. And then as I was watching it, I was like, huh, As a little girl, you know, in the 70s, this probably was really terrifying, you know. But I'm watching it now and it is just a little bit weird. You know, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. I had fun with it. And I definitely see why, you know, why it's paired up with Nope. That makes a lot of sense. But it, yeah, it's not, I'm not a big Hitchcock fan, but it's also, I don't imagine it'll be up there for me either.
Yeah, the funny thing is that I am quite afraid of birds and I was still not scared. Like, I think there is one kind of quite, I can see it's a scary reveal where we sort of find a person who has had their eyes pecked out by birds. And I think there is quite a primal fear about, you know, people that do find nervous around birds that they're going to go for your eyes. But beyond that, I don't know, were there any moments of great suspense for you guys?
I think actually, and this is kind of a cop-out answer, but I think the most suspenseful bit for me is near the end when you just, like, you know, they're kind of leaving and you just see all the birds waiting. And that, I was like, yeah, birds do that. But birds be waiting. The other day I was at Hampstead Heath and I was sat in the cafe bit with my friend Steph, and there's a big sign on the wall that says, do not leave food unattended or birds may eat it. And I thought that was really funny, so I took a picture of it. And then the woman next to us left, and she had left her, like, half her breakfast. And, oh my God, that was more terrifying than the birds. Just seeing. So it started with one crow, and then another crow. And then suddenly there were, like, 20 crows all just, like, fighting over this, like, half a thing of beans and toast. And that was very scary. So I do understand where Hitchcock is coming from. And I mean, this was based on a story, wasn't it? It was based on a De Maurier story. So I totally understand that fear, but I think the real thing is so much scarier than this film.
Yeah, no, I would say that as well. And I just remembered, actually, my first introduction, there was this, like, BBC drama years ago where Toby Jones was playing Hitchcock. And it was, I don't know if it was just, I really don't remember it at all, but I don't know if it was explicitly about the making of the birds, but it was just basically about how Hitchcock, you know, not the best guy.
Yeah, tortured Tippi Hedren for this film, basically.
Yeah, yes. And that's what, that was my earliest memory of the birds. It's Toby Jones torturing whichever blonde actress was playing Tippi Hedren. And I just remember the relentlessness of shooting that attic scene over and over again. So then when I actually watched the film, I was like, oh God, like, this is going to be torturous for me to watch. And I mean, it, you know, was a million times more torturous, obviously, to shoot, because I didn't really feel much towards it. But that was my, you know, my first memory of the birds. And I think that it was probably more horrifying than the film, really, his treatment, I suppose. Yeah,
it's so funny because so much of Nope is about kind of the lengths to which people will go to kind of create cinema and to create spectacle and stuff. And as I do love Hitchcock, and, you know, I've worked my way through many a Hitchcock box set in the past, but there's a kind of slight disappointment about, like, oh, well, you know, like, Kubrick basically tortured people, and, like, Coppola kind of tortured people in order to make these masterpieces. And it's just like, oh, God, Tippi Hedren got tortured for this mediocre, like, entry in the Hitchcock oeuvre. Like, that's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, it is.
If you're going to suffer for your art, at least be creating vertigo. Okay, let's move on to our second film cub entry, Jaws. When a killer shark unleashes chaos on a beach community off Cape Cod, it's up to a local sheriff, a marine biologist, and an old seafarer to hunt the beast down. Rogan, I've got to assume you've watched Jaws before, and I'd say that this is a film that terrified our parents, but probably terrified us as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think my uncle when I was younger was like a big Spielberg. I mean, no one in my family's a massive film person, but he was like, Jaws, Jurassic Park, that's the stuff. Like, that, you know, and that, those two films. So I kind of have really vague memories from when I was young, but then I've obviously watched it since. It's another one that has great rewatch value, in the same vein as Nope. And yeah, I had a great time rewatching it for this. I mean, I haven't seen it a great deal of times, maybe four times throughout my life. But I'm still shocked at the bloody size of that shark. every time the reveal, I'm like, Jesus wept. But yeah, no, it was a great one watching it for this. And yeah, and you definitely see the direct influence on Nope for sure, and in all the best ways.
Yeah, it does seem strange that if this film, A, is a PG, but also was the biggest film, you know, biggest box office ever for quite a long time. The fact that, like, a child gets ripped to pieces in front of their mother, like, 10 minutes in. And it's that, not...
The bit with the leg. Ugh.
Yeah, they kind of... Often I think Jaws is talked about as being like, ooh, like the power of suggestion. But there's also quite a lot of not suggestion.
The straight up violence. Yeah, even against these sharks, like we see some pretty gross.
The blowing up at the end, which I was like, oh, of course, you know. But yeah, that was pretty rough. Just seeing, you know, shark guts just in the
rain
sky.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of my favourite episodes of Mythbusters is that they actually build a kind of realistic shark and they do test that out and it would work. Oh. That shark would have blown up had he landed that shot. let's get back to the... So one of the things that's kind of infamous about Jaws is that, like, they planned to use that mechanical shark a ton and then it kept breaking. So they had to come up with other ways to kind of suggest that it's there. And that's something that very much recurs in Nope, the way that they kind of suggest the presence of the object without showing it to you explicitly. Just wondering, in Jaws, were there any particular favourites that you had? Because we've got music, we've got barrels, we've got loads of different ways.
Ooh, I think the musical cue is so iconic, and just the idea of John Williams having, like, done all this, like, all these, like, possible... bits of music, and then it was just that two note that Spielberg was like, that's the stuff, that's what we want. He's like, really, two note, okay, fine. But it is, like, it's iconic for, like, a good reason, you know. It has haunted swimming pools ever since, and I'm a big music nerd anyway, so, like, the power of suggestion with music I find so exciting. And, you know, this really is, I think, a proto you know, one of the ones we always go back to in filmmaking. And I think you see it as well in Nope. The score for Nope is amazing. We didn't even really get to touch on that. But that is, I think, probably my favourite part, rewatching it now as an adult and not a terrified child. But I also, like, on a different subject, I just want to, like, highlight the fact that Richard Dreyfuss and Roy Schneider in this film are very hot. Yeah. And I enjoyed that as well.
Also, you know, under what people don't talk about is how snappily dressed that mayor is. Like, there is a crisis happening. He is running an island. It's the height of the season. And that man puts a pastel suit together with such aplomb. Every time I rewatch this film, I'm just like, I appreciate the effort that this man is taking. He gets reelected in Jaws 2, but I can see why.
Even though he wanted to reopen the beach, he was just constantly like, oh, this shark thing's fine, like, it's not going to be a big issue. I also think that as well ties back into Nope pretty nicely, this idea of, like, writing off threat in pursuit of profits. I think is like a kind of through line in Nope, and I think very true to life, is that capitalism will always kind of win out against, like, human tragedy, which is very depressing.
I mean, I remember at the start of the pandemic, so many people, you know, this very start of a lockdown, people were going, yeah, it's like in Jaws when they just told us, you know, when they wanted to open the beach, it's like these government officials are saying, you know, just keep swimming. You know, that kind of mentality. But yeah, it's also it's just kind of the hubris of man, just that, yeah, I can, you know, I'm greater than this thing. I can handle this thing. I can control this. I can cage this. I can, you know, it's not greater than me. I'm good, you know. And that, again, in Jaws and in Nope, just great through line.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the book that this is based on, which is not very good, so I don't recommend anyone read it, the mayor is being, like, blackmailed by the mob in order to keep the beaches open. And I think it's just so much more interesting when you kind of, you know, you don't need that. You actually just need somebody that's after quite a minor amount of power, which is like quite depressing in a way. Like, it's like he doesn't even have like a great ambition or a threat to his life. It's just like, no, I want our arcades and local restaurants to do well, and for me to take this like maintain this mayor job on this island which has got just a few thousand inhabitants and one sheriff who's big. Like, and I love that his crime that he's investigating at the start of it is that little boys are karate chopping fences after their karate class.
Yeah, I do love Chief Brody is like so beleaguered. he's just the last thing this man needs is a killer shark. He's really like, you know, he's already kind of doesn't really want to be there very much, and you know, he's kind of bickering with his wife and his kid. All his like annoying son wants to do is go swimming, and I felt very much kind of very much on his side. And you know, kind of, I love that central dynamic between we have Dreyfus and Robert Shaw, who I think is just so good as Quint. Like, just that when he does his little speech about surviving the
USS Indianapolis,
which is again another moment that has like passed into the pop culture annals of history because it's so good. That central, like, yeah, that central trio of Dreyfus, Schneider and Shaw, when they're just like hanging out on the boat together, it's just like it almost becomes this kind of buddy movie, just like three guys trying to catch a shark. Which, you know, there's so many levels to this, very much like Nope, in that the reason it's so effective as a thriller is because you get those moments of levity and those moments of kind of storytelling beyond just kind of the pure terror of this shark coming from the deep to gobble up people.
Yeah, and I think the performance that Rory Schneider gives of Brody is so underrated, because I love that, again, a bit like Nope, that it's not fully explained. Like, there's kind of, clearly he's left the city for some reason, something bad happens, and just after, before that SS Indianapolis speech, you kind of see him, when they're comparing scars, reach up and there's a glimpse of what seems to be a bullet wound, and there is an idea that he really did not need this shit, and he has to overcome his fears, much like Daniel Kaluuya in Nope. There's a lot of parallels. If you love Jaws, you're gonna love Nope. But you know, that he overcomes like an innate fear in himself and kind of rises to the occasion. So like, as much as this is like a brutal film, I think it's incredibly feel good and triumphant at the end.
Yeah, not unless you're a shark. This film did damage the shark community, I will say. Like, after Jaws came out, sharks like really could have done with a win in terms of PR, and it really, I'm pretty sure that there were like ramifications for like the great white shark in terms of like it being seen as this man-eating menace, which really is not, like, it's not that common at all for sharks to attack people, which is why it's such an effective film, I guess. But it really plays on this fear of the unknown that we have, especially about the ocean. I'm terrified of open water, not because of Jaws, I just think we don't know enough about it. Don't know what's going on down there. The only man we've got down there is James Cameron. He's not telling us everything.
So it's the image of James Cameron, like, that's where he lives. Yeah, no, my friend Bolu, she calls it monster soup. Like, the sea, the ocean is just monster soup. You don't know what's down there. You just you just stir it up once and God knows what will come flying out there. Like, no.
It's, I guess, Nope and Jaws are playing on our two big fears of the unknown, which is the depths of the ocean and what is out there watching us in space. They make it, someone should do it as a double bill at the cinema, because I think they would work. You would come out a nervous wreck, but it would be great to see both on a big screen, one after the other.
Yeah, I mean, a deep dive on Nope is like about surveillance culture. I mean, that's a thing. There's just so much to unpick. It's so good.
Yeah, no, and we've come to the end of our time together, which I'm really sad about, because this has been like one of the more fun weeks. Well, I mean, no criticism to former guests. It's just, I really love Jaws and I really love Nope. But yeah, I mean, it just, you know, I know that kind of nostalgia is kind of a bit of a sickness, but it really feels like they don't give a 27-year-old guy with a dream, a giant budget to go off and make a kind of crazy shark kid murdering movie anymore. And I wish it happened more of it. And, you know, as an early Spielberg fan, it was just a joy to revisit. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, more Hitchcockian thrills in Babak Anvari's I Came By. Esther is up to no good again in the prequel Orphan First Kill. And on Film Club, the terror doesn't relent with Silence of the Lambs. God, lots of great scary films at the moment. I'm loving this. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Rogan Graham and Hannah Strong. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Jake Cunningham.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.